Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Department of Classical Studies titled Personal Agency and the Big Switch, 1962 to 64, Thucydides, Bob Dylan, and Stanley Kubrick. Our speaker is Professor Thomas Palaima from the University of Texas at Austin. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Classical Studies Professor Herbert Golder.
Tom Palaima is a MacArthur Fellow in 1985 to 1990, and he's the Robert M. Armstrong Centeno Professor of Classics and founding director of the program in Aegean Scripts and Prehistory at the University of Texas at Austin. So it's very nice to have him here. He has held Fulbright Fellowships and professorships in Greece, Austria, and Spain, and is a Fellow of the Society of Antiquaries, London. He has used his expert knowledge of Linear B and other proto-writing systems to study and write on numerous facets of social and cultural life in the earliest Greek prehistory, from religion and ritual to kingship and warfare. But Tom is not your everyday garden variety Mycenaologist. He has also written copiously on a broad range of subjects, ancient and modern, is a regular commentator for the past 20 years for the Austin American Statesman, a regular reviewer and occasional feature writer for the Times Higher Education in London. He is that all too rara avis, a public intellectual who is also a true polymath, and perhaps the only Mycenologist to have also written polemically and with some heat on the damage done to higher education by big-time college sports. But a very special area of interest, and one Tom has written on prolifically, concerns the human response to experiences of war and violence. For 25 years at UT Austin and elsewhere, he has taught seminars on this, the bare-forked experiences of man, combatants, ancient and modern, and the experiences of those caught between. I am pleased and indeed very proud to announce that his recent Orion essay, War Stories Told, Untold, and Retold from Troy to Tinian to Fort Campbell, has been nominated for inclusion in Best Essays of 2016. Tom has also written and taught extensively on song as an important means of communicating social criticism. His is a mailing list you want to be on. His collection of Michael Ventris's original papers may only be rivaled by his Dylan playlist. And he's here today to give us a talk entitled Personal Agency and the Big Switch, 1962 to 64, Thucydides, Bob Dylan, and Stanley Kubrick. Welcome, Tom.
Well, thank you so much. I wanted to thank Herb for setting this all up, and given the fact that I think this is a really important topic, because it deals with how someone who was an influential cultural force himself was trying to come to terms with what he could say about the human experience. The more I look at Dylan and his songs, the more I read what he's written, I see that he really sees human beings and he tries to make sense of them, and that's going to be problematical for anybody. In the years around a Cuban Missile Crisis, the A-bomb caused a paradigm shift in how folk songs protested against or even just spoke to or about war and about those who lead us into and in war and against what war does to human beings. All those prepositions are important, and in fact they're problematical and have to be nuanced, and in them lie the secrets I'm trying to get at in this paper. The A-bomb itself was the horrific endgame of the mechanized warfare introduced in World War I that produced the bitter, ironic poems of Secret Sassoon, Wilfred Owen, and Ernest Hemingway, and novels like All Quiet on the Western Front, Johnny Got His Gun, which was published in 1939 but republished in 1959 and 1960 in a very popular mass paperback at a time when Dylan was picking up on this kind of stuff. And the conclusion of Johnny Got His Gun, I'm sure, influenced Masters of War. Soon would come Walter M. Miller's post-nuclear apocalyptic science fiction, A Canticle for Leibowitz, and Joseph Heller's American Iliad, Catch-22. All at the time when Dylan is starting out his career in Minnesota and then in New York. As Bob Dylan recognized in his famous on-the-air interview with Studs Terkel in late April 63, traditional character-specific songs concerned with the trauma affecting every man's soldiers, like Dylan's own John Brown, had no place in a world where whole cities and armies could be wiped out by what Dylan characterized as an amoral god tended to by scientific worshipers and military acolytes. Instead, songs that asserted resignation to larger forces and a choice of personal human dignity and death, like Dylan's own Let Me Die in My Footsteps, became appropriate. But these kinds of songs were at odds with, or at least potentially at odds with, songs like A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall and Masters of War. And Dylan himself has performed Let Me Die only once at the Fingen Club in Montreal in July 2nd, 1962. So he himself recognized early on that this wasn't the kind of song that he wanted to keep performing. Kubrick's ironic use at the beginning and end of Dr. Strangelove of the Civil War song When Johnny Comes Marching Home and Vera Lynn's romantic and wildly popular World War II song We'll Meet Again also underscores this shift. And here what we'll be doing is examining the schizophrenia-producing forces of the Cold War from 1959 to 1965 that operated on Bob Dylan as he made his way to who he was to become, and how this shift reflected Dylan's changing view of the world and the music he was comfortable producing. We might call this shift the shift from Dylan's I Was Young When I Left Home, which is recorded in December 61, and 51 Highway, November 61, to his own Highway 61, which came out in August 1965. And Highway 61 is a war song. We might also call this the shift from No More Auction Block to No More Death of Emmett Till's. As Dylan abandons appeals to moral conscience and shaming exhortations to moral action, in what he himself refuses to call topical songs, and moves towards the kinds of satire we find in Heller and Kubrick. Key in this will be to listen to what Dylan himself is saying, especially his last thoughts on Woody Guthrie, April 12, 1963, the Studs Terkel radio program, April 26, 1963, and his Tom Paine Award dinner speech in December of 63, and the follow-up letter of apology in the ancient Greek sense. It's an explanation, not an apology in our modern sense of the word. But first, the Thucydides component. This intersects with Dylan and is an important thing to understand who Dylan is and what he's trying to get at. Secretary of State George Marshall, in a speech at Princeton in 1947, said, "I doubt seriously whether a man can think with full wisdom and deep conviction regarding certain of the basic international issues today who has not at least reviewed in his mind the period of the Peloponnesian War." Marshall assumes a working knowledge of Thucydides, as many of the leading statesmen then would have, and his advice was well taken for good and bad. The Foreign Service Journal for August 1952 contains an article called A Message from Thucydides, and we see the first page of it here by a person named Louis J. Hall, or Halley, I don't know how to pronounce his name, I've never heard it pronounced. It strikes me that Hall's, I'll use that pronunciation, vision of Thucydides as someone with the power of making alive and self-explanatory the events of the present in writing that was vivid and poignant, reflects what Dylan, when starting out, found in traditional Appalachian folk songs, country and urban blues, the music of Woody Guthrie, and the music collected, recorded, transcribed, and analyzed by Child, the Lomaxes, Chris Strachwitz, and Cecil J. Sharp. Here's Dylan, August 24th, 1997, in his Wolf Trap bootleg. He has just played Blind Willie McTell, which just evokes the atmosphere of the old plantation South and the cruelty and racism that prevailed there. And he says from the stage, "There's a distinguished gentleman here who came. I want to introduce him, named Alan Lomax. I don't know if many of you have heard of him." The audience applauds. "Yes, he's here. He's made a trip out to see me. I used to know him years ago. I learned a lot there, and Alan was one of those who unlocked the secrets of this kind of music. So if we've anybody to thank, it's Alan." Dylan then cries out, "Thank you, Alan," as the band launches into a pulsating version of Dylan's post-Newport Electric war song, Highway 61. Hall goes on to highlight as the chief attribute of Thucydides' unique genius his ability to apply his detached vision to a scene in which he stood himself, and to events in which he was a participant. He had both the close-up view and the distant perspective on his material, and he had them simultaneously. Well, Mutatis Mutandis, that's Bob Dylan, only in a slightly altered way. Thucydides shaped the conception American leaders post-World War II had of who we were as a cultural force in the world, and who they were as the managers of the awful power of our nation. They were those of whom Trumbo wrote in the concluding sentence of Johnny Got His Gun, "You plan the wars, you masters of men. Plan the wars and point the way, and we will point the gun." Thucydides also attracted Dylan's attention in his Chronicles, Volume 1, and Richard Thomas knows this passage well, admitting to being raised in a cultural spectrum that had left my mind black with soot. Dylan recalls staying in a Greenwich Village apartment of friends and coming upon a personal library that contains Thucydides, among other things. Dipping into it, he finds, quote, "a narrative which would give you chills. It was written 400 years before Christ, and it talks about how human nature is always the enemy of anything superior." Thucydides writes about how words in his time have changed from their ordinary meaning, how actions and opinions can be altered in the blink of an eye. It's like nothing has changed from his time to mine. Notice he doesn't say to ours. This is clearly a case of like calling to like in terms of being able to recreate with the pragmatic and world-weary moral distance of a traditional folk or blues songster or of a former Athenian general, Dylan's Mississippi. Say anything you want to, I have heard it all. Scenes of human beings behaving as human beings do. And Dylan sees in Thucydides the same kind of timeless universality that he talks about in his last thoughts on Woody Guthrie, and the same kind of clear-visioned insight into human hearts of darkness that Dylan captures in Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll or Only a Pawn in Their Game. And here's a clip of Only a Pawn in Their Game, just a little snippet of it so you get a sense. This is Dylan, and keep in mind, he's 22 years old here, and he's in the March on Washington up there on stage with Martin Luther King in one of the greatest mass social events in American history. And there's Bob Dylan doing this.
I would like now to introduce the 50 singer from New York, Bob Dylan.
Bullet from the back of a bush, sitting at your ever's blood. His finger finds the trigger to his name. Hey, hey, looking out in the dark, the hand sets his spark, two eyes took the heat. Behind him and green, but he ain't green. He's only a pawn.
I just wanted to play a snippet of that song, but there you hear him singing about the death of Medgar Evers, and it's a very hard-hitting and specific song. Thucydides could well have written the same kind of passage. Thucydides' history, according to Hall, an intelligent and knowledgeable foreign policy expert, was the tragedy of Athens, and he says it was a Shakespearean rather than a Greek tragedy, since he argues the doom suffered by men in Greek tragedy comes from without, a malignant principle in the cosmos. And in this, he more or less is in line with thinkers who have contemplated the purposes of written and performed tragedies in connection with our chances of leading good lives. Still, Hall maintains that the downfall of Athens lay in her inability to live up to the moral responsibility that had come to her as a result of her moral excellence. Here we can only shake our heads and be grateful for Dylan's takeaway from Thucydides. Hall's reading, of course, explains the real tragedy of American Cold War foreign policy. It is based on the delusion of American exceptionalism, an unflinching confidence that the greatness of the American way of life is based on and comes out of the moral excellence that guides our decisions and determines our actions. It comes from a straight-faced, blinkered reading of Pericles' funeral oration, and belief in the claim of universal feelings of charis that Athens, and the United States as a modern Athens, has created by its constant use of military force in building up an empire and subjugating and then exploiting former allies, 477 to 431 BC and beyond. Greek tragedy needs and has no morally excellent heroes. In fact, the moral universe of the Greeks is the moral universe of blues singers and old folk songsters and William Faulkner, who sing and write about a world gone wrong with no sane hopes that it will ever be righted. Those who have been wrong can only endure and endure and endure, as Faulkner puts it, a world where the William Sansingers, Bud Russells, Tom Moores, the Thorpes, corrupt judges, lords and masters of war hold sway, and seven curses, as in Dylan's folk song Seven Curses, and death curses, as in Masters of War, can be conjured up and hurled with no reason to believe that they will ever have any effect. To switch back to Dylan now, in this period he really is, to quote his song Foot of Pride, learning how to carry a burden too heavy to be yours, and he eventually realizes that. He was born on May 24, 1941, in Hibbing, Minnesota, which is 76 miles northwest of Duluth, through which passes Highway 61 that runs from the Mississippi Delta up to La Crosse, Wisconsin, over into Minnesota, up to Minneapolis, then to Duluth, and along the north shore of Lake Superior into Canada. In Chronicles Volume 1, he describes the kinship he feels with that route that supplied the title of his sixth album. Highway 61, the main thoroughfare of the country blues, begins about where I began. I always felt like I'd started on it, always had been on it and could go anywhere, even down into the deep Delta country. It was the same road, full of the same contradictions, the same one-horse towns, the same spiritual ancestors. It was my place in the universe, always felt like it was in my blood. Paul Oliver, a blues scholar, the meaning of the blues, says, for the migrant Negro, the long ribbons of these odd number highways, Highway 61 among them, on whose hard causeway countless thousands of flapping soles and bare black feet have made no indentation, these are the best known routes to the southern Negroes in their mass exodus to the south, especially after World War II. As we're leading into what he's doing in this period of the early Cold War, 59 to 65, it starts out at the University of Minnesota. He's in Dinky Town. He doesn't pay attention to classes. At one point, he says he went there for a semester. But what he did learn in Minneapolis, deeply steeped in the music of folk musicians, Appalachian music, race music, English, Scottish, Irish folk ballads. He talks about a fall day in 1960 where a woman named Flo Kastner in Gray's drugstore counter invited him to listen to a collection of Guthrie's music that her brother had in his apartment. And when he does, it is earth-changing for him. He says that it gave him a kind of a voice in his head, said, so this is the game. I could sing all these songs, every single one of them, and they were all I wanted to sing. And literally, for about a year to 15 months, this was all he sang. He became Woody Guthrie, literally became Woody Guthrie. And he said, Woody's got a fierce poetic soul, the poet of hard crust sod and gumbo mud. He divides the worlds between those who work and those who don't, and is interested in the liberation of the human race and wants to create a world worth living in. This is all in Chronicles, in the early 2000s, written in the early 2000s. And this is all sincere stuff. I mean, so what Dylan is doing here is saying that he's attuned to all the timeless inequities of human culture, the rich versus the poor, the racism, the bad luck that hits people. And he wanted to just absorb it, to become the man who represented this in the American folk tradition. And that's what to be kept in mind as he's starting out in New York. And he says, now that I crossed the divide, and he determined to sing Woody and to go see Woody. And then look at, the sun had swung my way. I felt like I crossed the threshold and there was nothing in sight. Singing Woody's songs, I could keep everything else at a safe distance. There's a comfort in it too, to becoming Woody Guthrie. It's as if all the crap of the world falls away and the things that are important to be a human being are right before him. So To me, it's utterly remarkable. The way I put it here, what Dylan was absorbing through Guthrie and the other music he listened to, a near half century of the social injustice of income disparity and man's inhumanity to man. From the Ludlow, Colorado massacre, orchestrated by John D. Rockefeller in April 20th, 1914, through to the mistreatment of Okies at the California border, if you don't have the do-re-mi, to the migrant work hands exploited and ground down, harvesting produce from our pastures of plenty, to this land being somebody's my land and not our land, to the theft from the poor with a fountain pen that would cause the justified resentment that leads to the heroizing of pretty boy Floyd. Otherwise, you learn from Guthrie that the working class lives out anonymous lives, whether they are migrants killed and left nameless in a fireball of lightning that shook our hills in Los Gatos Canyon, or U.S. Navy men on the USS destroyer Reuben James, sunk near Iceland on October 31st, 1941. Guthrie's first instinct in writing to Reuben James, he wanted to sing out the names of all the Navy men killed. He wanted to sing out 240-some names. And Pete Seeger said to him, nobody's going to go for that. But that's what is his instinct. These were important human beings. They died. That's what I want to sing. And everybody should listen and know the names of all these people. And so he then massaged it. What were their names? What were their names? Does anybody know the names of the sailors on the Reuben James? And that's what Dylan is soaking in. Here's the Guthrie timeline, and I'm not going to go through all this, but it's important to realize how Dylan is starting out. By the time Dylan, as you see in blue there, Sunday, January 29th, 1961, by the time he meets Woody Guthrie, Guthrie has already been involuntarily hospitalized with Huntington's chorea for 5 years. And the state he is in is just a terrible state. We get various observations on it. Whether he could even be articulate is one thing. He certainly wouldn't have been able to play guitar any longer and so forth. So Dylan crosses the United States to see this heroic figure and find somebody in advanced stages of nervous system degeneration. And that must have had a powerful effect on him as well. He himself hits New York in 1961. He hops on a bus on January 29th and goes to see Woody, come face to face. And the first song that he writes of his own is Song to Woody. He tells Studs Terkel later, when Terkel asks him on the radio program, can you play Song to Woody? And he said, no, I only play that for Woody Guthrie. I mean, he now in concert, thank God, plays amazing versions of it. But at the time, he said this was a very special. What people don't really give enough emphasis to is on April 12, 1963, he recites a long poem at the end of his New York Town Hall concert, 6 pages of it, Last Thoughts on Woody Guthrie. Last Thoughts on Woody Guthrie. It's saying, Auf Wiedersehen, Woody. And 1963, December 13th, in the Tom Wayne Payne Award speech, I wish sometimes I could have come here in the 1930s, like my first idol. Used to have an idol, Woody Guthrie, who came in the 1930s. But it sure has changed and so forth. So he's already marking out in 1963 a significant shift. I used to be Woody Guthrie, but I'm not anymore. And Woody used to be my idol, but he's not anymore. He's still a past idol, but he's not going to be the person through whom I filter the world any longer. When we shift to 1962, red is Woody Guthrie. You can see nothing of Woody Guthrie's at these live performances. And he's playing some more of his own songs, and these are the topical songs dealing with race, Death of Emmett Till, and the concerns of the Cold War, Blowing in the Wind, Let Me Die in My Footsteps, Poverty, Rural Poverty, Ballad of Hollis Brown, Warfare, John Brown, and then this apocalyptic view, A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, and then a love song, Don't Think Twice. But when we come to his discography, the blue is traditional music. The first two albums have traditional songs. The first album, almost predominantly, two Dylan songs, Talkin' New York and Song to Woody, but both with a lot of Woody in them. And then the freewheeling, you can see almost dominated by Dylan's own music. And then he's making his shift till we get down to Highway 61 at the bottom. when we come to other forms of expression, there's usually a significant time lag, and I'm not going to belabor the point here other than to say if you look at classic war literature, the things that stand out, Tim O'Brien's Things They Carried, Heller's Catch-22, Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-5, takes a long time to process. But with topical folk songs and with folk traditional songs, you can produce stuff almost immediately, and sometimes you need to. Dylan has these same qualities when he's addressing racial violence. The death of Emmett Till, which recounts the death of Emmett Till in August 1955, a Chicago teenager going down the Money, Mississippi to visit relatives over the summer, but is operating on Chicago standards of racism, not Southern standards of racism. There's the northern version of apartheid operating up in Chicago, just as in all northern cities. But it's not institutionalized as in the Jim Crow South. And the mere contact of a Negro, as they're called in the period, with a white woman would not bring about the death of the Negro as a response. But it does in Money, Mississippi. And so he goes into Bryant's grocery and meat market in Money, Mississippi on the evening of August 24th, egged on by his cousin relatives, and says, well, yeah, you say you talk to white women up north. Why don't you go and do it? And he does. And the accounts are a bit murky as to what he gave a wolf whistle, whether he actually touched her. But it was enough when the husband came back 4 days later to want to teach this boy a lesson. And he goes with his own brother-in-law, takes him away from the house, and then whatever their original intention, it ends up with him absolutely bludgeoned and dumped with a ginning fan strapped around his neck in the Tallahatchie River. And Dylan is encouraged to write about this by his girlfriend of the period, Susie Rotolo, who was very committed to progressive politics for the benefit concert in the Congress of Racial Equality. And he comes out with something that's very preachy, but very direct. If you can't speak out against this kind of thing, a crime that's so unjust, your eyes are filled with dead men's dirt. Your mind is filled with dust. Remember, he says, when he was starting out, his mind was filled with black soot, right? So he couldn't see things clearly. Your arms and legs, they must be in shackles and chains, and your blood, it must refuse to flow, for you let this human race fall down so god-awful low. This is a kind of direct preachiness that eventually becomes absent from his songs. But the graphic details that he gives in The Death of Emmett Till and these other songs come right out of this tradition of having to try to capture the realities and communicate them. Oxford Town, during the same period, in fall of 62, about James Meredith's experience as the first black person to attend the University of Mississippi. He then moves on to intense real incidents-focused masterpieces. The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll is familiar to most people, but again, it's about the death of a 51-year-old black hotel servant lady in a Baltimore hotel at a society gathering at the hands of William Devereaux Zant Zinger. Dylan, in his song, as is well known too, heats up the song using Tim O'Brien's idea of what you have to do to communicate the realities of a situation in war. Or what Werner Herzog calls ecstatic, ecstatic truth, right? So this is what Dylan is after. So he has Zanzinger's Cain be literally causing the death and wanting to kill all that is gentle and things of this sort. And so Dylan is sometimes taken to task by critics to say, well, William Zanzinger had one distant relative who had some connection with Maryland politics. But he says, well, high office relations in the politics of Maryland. What Dylan is doing is trying to use this not as a police report, but to try to use it as something that will galvanize and make people feel what the racism, even in this tap of a kind of toy cane, but it was the brutality of the racism that Zanzinger was spewing out of his mouth at her that caused her to faint away and eventually die because of the condition of her health. Only a pawn in their game, August of 63, and then performed though, July 6th, in 1963, down in Greenwood, Mississippi. The shooting death of NAACP Field Secretary Medgar Evers, who was killed on June 12th. So Dylan quickly produces a song and performs it down in Greenwood, Mississippi. But Dylan himself hadn't been committed to going on any of the civil rights marches in the South. It was Theodore Bickel who urged Dylan's manager to give Bob a ticket and have him really see the South. If he's going to be writing about it, he ought to see it. So he goes down, it seems to be, just for a single day and performs the song, and we're going to see the snippet now of it. What's to be noticed here, though, is Dylan is not content simply to describe this in a sort of traditional way. He's trying to figure out what makes people tick. And so the virulent and unrepentant, this is almost formulaic, white supremacist Byron De La Beckwith, who shoots and kills in the back Medgar Evers, Dylan thinks about what it's like to be him. What causes him to do that? What causes a normal poor white guy to want to kill? And so he says he's a dupe too. It's the power people, the people who control the power, that set white against black among the poor people, because that keeps them in power. And so in the song he does this. And of course he's singing this now in Washington, D.C., right next to Martin Luther King, and saying, essentially, you all have problems with the racism of the whites against you, but keep in mind, the whites are dupes as well. They're being controlled as well. I mean, it's really spectacular when you think about it. I mean, would any of us in this room, on that kind of event, sing a song that said to this massed black audience, hey, the white guys have it bad too. They don't know what they're doing. It's terrible that they killed Medgar Evers, but he's only a pawn in their game, in their game. But this is in Greenwood, Mississippi. So look at the ambiance. He's like a dog on a chain. He ain't to blame. And look at this audience around him. They're looking like at Dylan like he's a space alien. Who is this guy, right? He comes down for a day, sings this one song, and leaves. I mean, this doesn't mean that he's not committed to it, but imagine being plunked. 4 days before, he was at Fingen Club in Montreal. Then he flies down here, sings a song that says, hey, the white guy is chained up by the masters of our society, and he ain't to blame for killing Medgar Evers. So this transition that Dylan's going through and the experience he's having are really, to me, in many ways, mystifying. Ballad of Hollis Brown is spectacularly evocative of the atmosphere of somebody who's going to kill his wife and children, and then himself, because of poverty, unrelenting poverty, grinding him down. And in the song, again, those of you who are much more familiar with Dylan than others know that he shifts perspective. He makes you pick up the gun and have it in your hand. And what am I going to do with this? You know, it is a spectacular song for creating atmosphere. In the Ballad of Hollis Brown, mass murder, rural poverty, his words are really, as I say, photorealistic. He can put himself there. He can put himself inside the mind of Hollis Brown. And Real Marcus, actually, in his article, says this reminds us of Wisconsin Death Trip by Michael Lisi, you know, the classic study of poverty and death in Black River Falls, Wisconsin, from 1890 to 1910. And also, it reminds us a bit of the atmospherics in the film version of In Cold Blood. So if you can take In Cold Blood and overlay it on a folk song that's like a war song and being just graphic about what's going on, and direct about what's going on, you understand the power of what Dylan's able to produce with these songs. And he's also certainly influenced both by, I think, a version by Tom Rush, which I had never knew existed and is not mentioned at all, but there's a version of Poor Man, this old Baton Rouge, Louisiana song by Jim Smoke and the Louisiana Honey Drippers, but the Tom Rush song on a self-released album. That it's hard to find the song, but I finally dug it up. This version of Poor Man is clearly the archetype for Dylan, and he's up around Harvard at the time, right? So in the green pastures of Harvard University. I'm sure this is where he got the song template from. And also the murder of the Lawson family, because the Stanley brothers, whom he reveres and covers a lot, do a version of it in 1956. And so he's doing this, but I think he's extremely conflicted. What can I do? What does it mean for me to go down to Greenwood, Mississippi, sing this song, and come back up? Especially because he realizes he's doing it in a part to please Susie Rodolo and Joan Baez. And at one point, he produces this song, Let Me Die in My Footsteps. It's lyrics and its style owe a lot to Woody Guthrie. He says, many people say it's not derived from any traditional ballad, but Dylan recently says, well, it's from an old Roy Acuff ballad. So he is adapting a song that he knows in his head to these this Let Me Die in My Footsteps. But he explains, I was going through some town, and they were making this bomb shelter right outside of town, one of these sort of Coliseum-type things. I was there for about an hour just looking at them build, and I just wrote the song in my head back then. But I carried it with me for 2 years until I finally wrote it down. As I watched them building, it struck me sort of funny that they would concentrate so much on digging a hole underground when there were so many other things they should do in life. If nothing else, they could look at the sky and walk around and live a little bit, instead of doing this immoral thing, right? Immoral thing. But it's all about his reaction, what he might do. In a fantasy world, if I had rubies and riches and crowns, I'd buy the whole world and change things around. But that's not going to happen, right? So let me drink from the waters where the mountain streams flood and so forth. And it's only at the end of the song that he even tries to engage the audience. Go out in your country where the land meets the sun and go out and see the United States in the way Woody Guthrie saw it. And you'll die in your footsteps before you go down under the ground. So as a protest song, as a commentary on contemporary issues, this is of a wholly different character from the ones we've reviewed so far. And what's remarkable to me here is how divorced the song is in the force of its delivery and its words, necessarily from any idea of effective personal agency and any hope of changing things or even achieving an emotional catharsis by spitting out anger as in Masters of War, or by conjuring up an apocalyptic vision of what is to come as in A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. It is almost as if Dylan is channeling the very passivity that catches his attention in the rather fantastic, but all too normal, advertising images from that period of happy American families of four dining in their suburban bomb shelters. The defiance that he recommends is not collective and organized resistance against immoral actions, as in the death of Emmett Till, against the dreadful powers of leaders who herd their whole people underground as they plan to release weapons that will bring about mutually assured destruction. The song does not, like Masters of War, curse those who would throw a worse fear than one that is the worst that can ever be hurled. In fact, it does not point out the consequences of what the power elites in the military-industrial complex are creating, fear to bring children into the world. Until its last stanza, it hardly even raises a call to others. Rather, it asserts an individual preference to go off and smell the flowers and live in the sun, and gaze up at the endless skyway, as Woody would have put it, and die that way, rather than be cooped up in a sunless underground bunker made to look like home in a happy domesticity sustained by canned goods. It is therefore, I would say, Yossarian-like, right? One individual saying, this ain't for me, I'll stand this one out. In its last stanza, it invites his listeners essentially to get out and experience this land, your land, my land, before the inevitable nuclear conflagration comes to pass. Later, in 1962, in A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, which was written just before it's performed at Carnegie Hall on September 22nd, we have a sort of different take. Dylan later claimed that its images, each line, were the distillations of whole songs that he compressed into one because he feared Taken as during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And so it's a good Dylan-esque story, but it's chronologically off. So it wasn't written during the Cuban Missile Crisis, but certainly in the tense atmosphere of the period. So there's enough going on so you don't need it to be written quite right then. And when Studs Terkel says to him, he really wants Bob to play this song, and Bob finally plays it in this interview that you can find online in April 1963. And Terkel says, well, that even though the hard rain's about nuclear fallout rain, he says, no, no, no. And look at what he says. It isn't the fallout rain. I mean, some sort of end that's just got to happen. In the last verse, when I say the pellets of poison are flooding the waters, that means all the lies that people get told on their radios and in their newspapers. When he's on the Terkel program, and even late in 62, he's looking around and saying, this world is messed up. And why is it messed up? Well, because people get told lies. You get told you can build a fallout shelter and live as a happy family down there. Watch Ozzie and Harriet and have canned peas TV dinners, and everything will be fine. And so we said, you know, people get told lies on their radio, and so the hard rain is connected to that. And there you see it. Spectacular song, but ending up, where hunger is ugly, where souls are forgotten, where black is the color, where none is the number, and I'll tell it and think it and speak it and breathe it. This is the most adamant he ever gets in these songs. I'll tell it, I'll think it, I'll speak it, and I'll breathe it, and reflect it from the mountain so all souls can see it. Then I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking, but I'll know my song well before I start singing. And if you just take those lines and look at them and analyze them, what is he saying? I have to know what I want to sing about, and then I have to sing it directly, and I have to, you know, I have to tell people black is the color. I have to tell them that none is the number, with all that implies. So when you say black is the color, none is the number, you're saying something. We all know what he's saying. This is desperate. This is dark. This is nihilistic in some ways. So something's coming on that's really bad. Souls are forgotten. Hunger is ugly. So this is really strong language. And he says, that's what I have to know before I start singing. And the hard rain's going to be coming on. I went out and read what Dylan was reading. When he said I'd never read Robert Gover's $100 Misunderstanding. He says Studs, when he's describing the song, he said to Studs Terkel, well, it's like what's in Robert Gover's $100 Misunderstanding, which was a wildly popular book at the period, about a white college fraternity kid and a 14-year-old black prostitute. And Dylan in 63 is saying, I read this book and this is what it's about, and it gives you different perspectives, what a black and a white person are thinking. And Gover writes the black in a black dialect. And that black dialect has ways of representing English that are found in Dylan's Tom Paine apology letter. I'm sure he was just soaking it in and saying, this is the way I got to write if I'm writing about this kind of thing. When he talks later about Masters of War, even on the freewheeling liner notes, he says, I've never written anything like that before. I don't sing songs which hope people will die, but I couldn't help it with this one. The song is a sort of striking out, but then what? A feeling of what can you do? He's moving to almost a cosmic aporia. I can sing these songs, but what are they accomplishing? And he has in the back of his mind, right, Greenwood, Mississippi. He has the March on Washington, and he sees what's going on. But what is his role in that? And when he sings these songs, what did they do? If we then look at the shift that Dylan goes through from this period of really, in 63, it's the high point of really intense, what he doesn't want to call topical songs. And I think he's right not to call them topical songs, because what he's saying is, I'm writing about the specific incident, but I am heating it up so much that it is transcending the individual incident. So it doesn't matter that Hattie Carroll only had 9 children and I said she has 10 or something, or she has 11 and I say 10. It doesn't matter. If I get the factual details, it can be manipulated. And so in my take of the matter, when you see him in the march on Washington in August 63 and down in Greenwood, Mississippi, to me it's almost like watching Woody Allen's Zelig. You have a person who is in these important historic settings, but he's sort of out of place, out of time, maybe even out of mind. And he himself is trying to figure out what to do about this. In December 13th, 1963, so 22 days after Kennedy's assassinated, he gets the Tom Paine Award and is expected to make a speech. And he makes a speech that is viewed as controversial, and what's he doing? He says he can understand what is sort of what Lee Harvey Oswald was getting at, and he can. But he doesn't really know how to talk about things. But listen to what he's saying, and this is really important. They talk about Negroes, and they talk about black and white, and they talk about colors of red, blue, and yellow. Man, I just don't see any colors at all when I look out. I don't see any colors at all, and if people have taught through the years to look at colors, I've read history books. I've never seen one history book that tells how anybody feels. I found facts about history. I found out what people know, what goes on, but I never found anything about anybody feels about anything, anything happens. It's all just, he was drunk at the time. It's all just plain facts, and it don't help me one little bit to look back. I want to accept this award, the Tom Paine Award from the Emergency Civil Liberties Committee. I want to accept it in my name, but I'm not really accepting it in my name, and I'm not accepting it in any kind of group's name, any Negro group or any other kind of group. There are Negroes. I was on the march on Washington up on the platform, and I looked around at all the Negroes there, and I didn't see any Negroes that looked like none of my friends. My friends don't wear suits. My friends don't have to wear suits. My friends don't have to wear any kind of thing to prove that they're respectable Negroes. But what you see them doing there is really, again, trying to figure out what the moral position to take, right? And how to deal with the magnitude of this. And when other people are saying, you deserve the Tom Paine Award, well, what does that mean? I don't know why I write this stuff, but I'm getting stuff out of my head. So he's gone a long way, and he's eventually going to shift to the kind of satire we see coming out in Subterranean Homesick Blues, Bob Dylan's 115th Dream, even with God on our side. Only he's going to apply it here to the masters and promoters of war and the Judeo-Christian warrior, Sky God, who's been advancing the cause of his chosen people for nearly three millennia. And we see this in the first and last stanzas of Highway 61. And they deal with what happens in war and how war is marketed. So here's where Dylan arrives at in 1965 after starting out as the Guthrie acolyte and absorbing all this stuff. Oh, God said to Abraham, kill me a son. Abe says, man, you must be putting me on. God say, no. Abe say, what? God say, you can do what you want, Abe, but the next time you see me coming, you better run. Well, Abe says, where do you want this killing done? God says, out on Highway 61. Now, the roving gambler, he was very bored. He was trying to create a next world war. He found a promoter who nearly fell off the floor. He said, I never engaged in this kind of thing before, but yes, I think it can be very easily done. We'll just put some bleachers out in the sun and have it on Highway 61. Just like you had the lynching and they're selling postcards of the hanging in Duluth in 1920. You just get all the people gather around and watch the terrible lynching of black men. Now you're going to be able to watch war the same way. This is the last of it. Highway 61 comes out, is recorded in early August 65. It's released in late August. And he gives a very sincere interview in September 65. Now, there's a lot of people writing songs on protest subjects, but it's taken some kind of a weird step. Hey, I'd rather listen to Jimmy Reed or Howlin' Wolf Man and others, he says, the Beatles and so forth, than I would listen to any protest singers. And then look at how careful he is, although I haven't heard all the protest singers there are. But the ones I've heard, there's this very emptiness, which is like a song written, let's hold hands and everything will be grand. I see no more to it than that. Just because someone mentions the word bomb, I'm not going to go, aye, and start clapping. It's not that it don't work. It's that there are a lot of people afraid of the bomb, right? But there are a lot of other people who are afraid of being seen carrying a modern screen magazine down the street, you know. Sure, you can make all sorts of protest songs and put them on a folkways record, but who hears them? The people who do hear them are going to be agreeing with you anyway. You aren't going to get somebody to hear it who doesn't dig it. And then in just a slightly later interview, he says, this is just fantastic. He's telling us what he's going through. I have not arrived at where I am now. I have just returned to where I am now. So what he's saying is, I had this whole formative period. I was Guthrie, and then with Susie and Joan Baez and everything else, the whole folk scene, I was that. And he actually says for Highway 61 that he came back from the tour in England, and he felt that he was singing these songs and they were empty and people were applauding, and he just couldn't figure it all out. And he said, I vomited forth 20 pages of verse, and then eventually distills it down to four and a half stanzas of Like a Rolling Stone. And as I said again, I think it's significant with all that we see here when he says the refrain is, how does it feel? And that's what he's after. He's after, what does it mean to be a human being? How does it feel? And what can you do to change the prevailing order if there are so many people in suffering? You know, especially when you've looked back at the Scottish, Irish, English, Appalachian folk tradition going back to the 17th century. And you see the same kinds of injustices prevailing. And so maybe you go the route that Heller and Kubrick go, and you do it through satire. But when you look at Highway 61, that's tough stuff. That's Wilfred Owen saying, we're sacrificing all our Isaacs. And then at the end it's saying, yeah, Eisenhower talked about the military-industrial complex, but what are we going to do about it? What's going on?
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Thomas Palaima from the University of Texas at Austin. Professor Palaima's lecture was titled Personal Agency and the Big Switch, 1962-64, Thucydides, Bob Dylan, and Stanley Kubrick, and was presented by the Boston University Department of Classical Studies. Tonight's moderator was Classical Studies Professor Herb Golder. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Ian McCarn. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us.